Okay, it's time for Tech Tuesday. Having looked back at the technology that's being brought back by hipsters, we're going to look forward to what is coming up. Facebook's been conducting all kinds of curious experiments on us, really, without our knowledge or consent, to find out what we, with how easy it is to manipulate our emotions, and also why you should safeguard your personal information. We have with us Belinda Smith, who is Deputy Science and Technology Editor at The Conversation in our Melbourne studio. Hey, Belinda.
Hello, Dom. How are you going?
I don't know if I'm doing, if I'm happy or sad. What's Facebook going to tell me?
Well, the experiment was actually done 2.5 years ago. So if you can think back that far to that 1 week where they actually did the experiment, then I think you're doing really well.
Yeah, I'll look back. I'll look back at the feed and see if they're prodding me with playing with my emotions.
That's right.
We also have with us Stilgarian, who writes for Crikey and ZDNet, among others. And you can also, if you don't mind swearing with your tech and opinions, the 9pm Edict is his podcast. Hello, Stil.
One of them. G'day, Dom. Hi, Belinda.
So, okay, let's start with this Facebook experiment. Belinda, you said that it was a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Facebook is you've got an audience of, what, a billion or something you can muck around with, and a lot of numbers to do these kind of psychological tests. What did they want to know?
Essentially, they wanted to know if emotional contagion was could be done through social networks. So the concept of emotional contagion is that you can spread emotions throughout people. So if I come up to you and I give you a big smile, you'll smile back and I'll make you happy. Whereas if I come up to you and kind of bare my teeth and growl at you, you might do the same back to me. That's the same sort of concept that they were trying to apply to the social networks.
Mm. So when we play a sax solo at the start of the show on Tuesday, so we're just sort of spreading passion amongst our audience. I like that, if indeed that's how it works.
Pretty much. So what Facebook did was they removed positive posts from some people's feeds and removed negative posts from other people's feeds. So people got a more positive or more negative feed for that week. And then Facebook analysed the posts that those people made to see if they were more negative or more positive than before. And they found there was an effect, albeit very, very, very small. And that's just one of the many issues with this study.
Okay, so they did the research and they found, I guess, what they were hoping to find doing that filtering. But still, now that news has come out, it'd be fair to say the emotion has been reasonably negative, at least from some, towards Facebook.
Oh, yeah. I gave them a bit of a serve in Crikey yesterday. The interesting thing about this, I mean, there should be mixed reactions, because at one sense, Facebook is just a big advertising platform. It's the job of an advertiser to manipulate our emotions to sell a product, whether we're talking, you know, buying a product, you know, believing the political candidate, whatever it is.
Yeah, if you've ever watched the Gruen Transfer, you'll know how that works.
Absolutely. They run through that. So at once, in one way, they're not doing anything that we didn't already expect them to do. But at the same time, this isn't a direct, okay, which kind of ad will we show them, and therefore how many new packets of toilet tissue did they buy this week, or did they change cigarette brands or whatever it was. It was purely, let's just see what mood that they changed. You know, did they withdraw? Did they write more negative comments on Facebook? Did they not even write as much, because people become withdrawn when they're feeling a bit down?
Right.
You just don't communicate as much. Now, when you do that with 700,000 people, there's going to be a few tens of thousands of people in there who are suffering depression, say, right at that time. And there's going to be a goodly few of them who just today, just this week, really don't need that one last push down the hole.
Mm.
You know, they're going to have a bad day, to say the least. The other thing is, although Facebook believes that they had informed consent on this, because in their data use policy, which is part of their 9,000-word terms and conditions, which, of course, we all read every time it changes, they say that they may use the data they collect for research purposes.
Yeah, and doesn't any point say in big letters, we will toy with your emotions. Is that fine, yes or no? But Belinda, what do you think? I mean, companies do this sort of thing all the time. I know Google, for instance, ran a massive experiment about which shade of blue was most pleasing to its customers for links. They kind of slightly changed the blue. But it's a bit different, isn't it, when they muck around with emotions and with the content that your friends have posted?
Yeah. Look, I'm not surprised that this happened. We reported on the paper when it came out last month, and our authors picked a whole heap of issues in the study. But, I mean, this isn't new. Facebook they've done this before in 2010 in the midterm elections in the US. They proudly bragged about it, actually, that they either put up banners saying four of your friends have voted, or with pictures of those people or no pictures, and they actually found that they had a greater voting turnout. I think it was about 300,000 extra voters, actually.
Oh, okay.
That's actually quite a big result.
Yeah.
Especially, what if you're in a swing state?
Voter turnout.
It's actual power.
Yeah, voter turnout's a huge issue in American elections, and it can determine the result, actually.
Exactly.
And imagine if there was a contest between legislators, some of whom were pro-Facebook, some of whom were anti. You wouldn't even know if they are, for instance, censoring the posts by the legislators or candidates who, you know, weren't acting in Facebook's interests. And I know that's all very scary in Big Brother. It's the kind of who was it that just wrote that book, the novel which I read about?
I'm afraid I'm not privy to your reading this,
Dom. No. That's the most vague question I've ever asked. Anyway, yep. So still, but it might all seem very, very conspiracy theory to think this way.
Well, the research was part studied by US military intelligence. Part funded
so
by.
So there you go. Not a Dave Eggers the circles. What I'm thinking of. By the way,
the whole art of persuasion became a science during World War II, when propaganda, and I mean in the neutral sense of the word, was getting people to, you know, eat less, save more money, work harder, you know, remember to turn your lights out because the enemy can see the cities, and all of those. What we really would just call public safety or public education campaigns, the people who learnt the techniques for what did and did not work then left those jobs during World War II and created the modern American advertising industry. And there's a book from the 1950s by Vance Packard called The Hidden Persuaders, where even then he was talking about how this might become a sinister thing. So, you know, when you start joining the dots, when you start thinking, well, we know how to make someone's mood change in certain ways. We know a lot about them. We know their interests because we are Facebook or we are Google and we have all of this data about them. At one level, it's what, you know, you can persuade people to go out and vote in America. That's fantastic. You know, freedom and democracy, that's a great thing. But what if a corporation decided to quite specifically favour one political candidate?
Yeah.
The effects are so subtle. I mean, the numbers we're talking about, the typical Facebook user, at any one time, the things that could appear in their newsfeed from their friends, family, business contacts, whatever, it's about 1,500 items. You can't show them all to the person at once. So Facebook has to make a decision of some sort about which ones to show. So where is the dividing line, if you like, between what's just, oh, we noticed you speak to Susan quite a lot. You must be closer to Susan than your other friends, so we'll make sure we show you most of Susan's stuff, you know, whatever. Or you start skewing it for commercial purposes. We saw that you were about to, you know, thinking about buying a car, so we'll show you car ads. That's good targeted advertising. What if we noticed that you had been looking at a site to give up smoking or alcohol? Well, smoking ads we can't have, but you were thinking about giving up alcohol, so maybe we'll ramp up the beer ads to counter that.
And I mean, look, surely no large media company or anything like that would ever take a position during an election campaign and actively try and promote one the other.
Exactly. Our experience here in Australia is very clear. No media company ever shows political bias.
Crazy, crazy conspiracy theory stuff. Belinda Smith is with us from The Conversation, and Stilgherrian is with us from many other fine media outlets, talking about technology on Tech Tuesday. We just talked about this thing with Facebook, and there's been quite a bit of, I guess, outrage because, you know, but we didn't know this was happening. It was sort of done without our consent. And it highlights, in a way, the enormous trust we place in these companies. And essentially, enormous amounts of our personal information we give to these companies willy-nilly without necessarily knowing what they're going to do with it. And still, one of the things that you were going to talk about was this notion that our credit cards are not nearly as important and valuable as our private information. And most of us guard our credit cards very, very safely, very, very carefully, but through our passwords, through our general online behaviour, we show very little concern for the safety of our personal stuff.
Yeah, look, this came out of a report last week. The Privacy Commissioner had finally issued reports on a data breach that happened last year when a dating site company called Cupid Media here in Australia. Now, this is an Australian company and not to be confused with OkCupid, which is an American dating site. They had, in January last year, their entire customer database stolen by hackers. We're talking names, in many cases, dates of birth, email addresses, passwords.
And quite possibly more embarrassing information as well.
Well, once you've got those passwords, you can, of course, log in to look at that embarrassing information. Or because Cupid ran a whole lot of specialty sites, it was people looking for Muslim dating, interracial dating, gay and lesbian. I can't remember whether they went into any kind of, you know, fetishish related things,
but potentially but things give information that people might want to keep secret.
Well, you know, you can certainly imagine the strife that would be caused if someone was advertising and looking for a threesome, but had not discussed that with their partner at that point, or a woman from a culture where it's expected that she marry within the culture, and she's found to be dating people, you know, young men not of that culture. That's going to cause family trouble if she would like to have that conversation at her own time, in her own way.
But again, still, Graham, and there's just no way that any unscrupulous media organisation would ever use passwords to access voicemail systems or secure systems.
It doesn't
never happen.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. In the report, the Privacy Commissioner mentions that Cupid has said, look, there wasn't any financial information taken, you know, no credit card numbers, no whatever. So we really don't need to keep this stuff quite as secure as someone who's keeping all that. The answer to that is, well, actually, no, because as a consumer, you are covered against fraudulent use of your credit card. The bank pays for that.
Yeah,
you know, you'll get your money
identify,
back.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless you've done something egregiously stupid, the bank will...
Like writing the PIN on the card, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you can change your credit card numbers. You can't change your date of birth. You can change your address, but, gee, it's a hassle.
Yeah.
You certainly can't change the fact that someone logged into your account because they heard that it had been hacked and they said, oh, what about Julian accounts? Let's try. Yeah, she's in the database the hackers had published online. Let's just see what photos she has. Oh, look at this photograph of Julie like that. That's all over the internet.
You can't put that genie back in the bottle, can you, I guess?
I mean, the Cronulla Sharks are learning that lesson very much this week, aren't they?
They certainly are. What are your thoughts about all this this privacy question, Blender? I mean, covering tech as you do, every week or two there's another story about some breach of password security.
That's right. It feels a bit like password fatigue, actually, when you're seeing it all the time. You're like, oh, target 7 million email addresses, credit card details, etc., etc. Again, it's just one of those things. You just have to deal with it. These big corporations, they say they have the best privacy possible, but when you've got ever more powerful hackers just brutally attacking these major corporations, it's really, really hard to sort of stay on top of things.
I think it's fair to say in Cupid's defence, they actually did really well. They detected that they had a problem within 3 days. And the statistics show that normally a data breach is only discovered months after the fact. And it's usually when some third party, like a contractor, is brought in to work on some specific issue, or whatever, the police discover the fact, or a journalist finds on a hacker exchange site or on the black market, hey, these appear to be all the logins for this company. And, you know, so all power to Cupid for getting that part right. The Privacy Commissioner even praised them for really discovering it quickly and then fixing the problems. And all right, they had some security practices to fix. So, you know, I'm not going to give them a complete wombat stamp here. but at the same time, Belinda's right. We hear this all the time and it's in the news, and a few days later our lives haven't immediately fallen apart. And so we don't think so much about it.
Yeah, and one of the big things is the need to use different passwords for different websites, because what they'll do is write a program that automatically uses the username or email address and password on heaps of different sites, and then they're in. But Belinda, you've been covering a story about a new type of password that doesn't require you to remember all these different phrases, because it's impractical if you're a member of 100 websites, potentially, exactly, to have a different website password on every website.
That's exactly right. I have to admit I'm guilty of this. I probably cycle through the same 5 or 6 passwords.
Oh, dear.
Not ideal. I know. I'm so sorry. This is really embarrassing.
That's right. You know, we all do it to some extent.
To some degree. That's right. But this is a sort of a new type of password. It relies on our brain's ability to really recognize faces. It's called FaceLock. It was published in a journal last year. It's quite a neat little idea. So what happens is a user specifies some people that are known to them. So they could be mates or family or celebrities that aren't massive celebrities, but maybe sort of niche celebrities like a famous drummer or someone. And then they have to select that face out of a group of 9 faces and go through a few pages like that. And these researchers found that that actually had a 97.5% accuracy rate, which is great.
I think, doesn't Facebook do that? When you get locked out, they, under some circumstances, actually show you pictures of your friends and get you to identify who they are.
Exactly, yes. It's great because the human brain is fantastic at recognising faces, even a photo of someone when we've never seen that photo before. If we know them well enough, we'll say, yes, that is Joe. But even if it's someone, if it's someone that's unknown to us, and even if we study that face for ages, if we see another photo of them, we're less likely to be able to correctly identify that person. And on a sort of similar note, a friend or a spouse or someone really close to you has a round about a 6% chance of correctly identifying people that you know in a lineup. So in terms of a password strength, it's quite good. You might think that, you know, your best mate might know a lot of the same people, but if you're good and you choose people from a wide range of groups, then the likelihood of someone guessing correctly is really low.
Interesting. So there you go. There's lots of solutions for trying to solve passwords still, and yeah, there are applications you can get that save all your passwords, but then what happens if they get compromised?
Well, that's right. You then have to go and change every single thing. But look, password management software is a good thing to have. I use one, and there's many good ones to choose from. So, you know, if you just look for password manager software review, you'll find, you know, magazine stories comparing them, and you can choose which one might be right for your needs. But it really comes down to, with that password management, yeah, if you can remember the password, it's probably not very good. And I don't know my passwords for most of the sites I log into. I do know the PIN for my bank account because I need to use it at an ATM.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But for all of the various internet sites I manage and pretty much all, no, I don't know the password. I just say password manager, click here, log me into this site. There's some interesting work happening too, though, that not just relying on what you remember, but a kind of contextual and reputation of you and your logins. For example, if I'm sitting here, I'm logging into, I don't know, my email or something, I have my tablet here in front of me. The Bluetooth can detect the fact it's there. It can detect the fact that my telephone is not too far away. It's in a location that matches my calendar, because it knows that I was meant to come into the ABC tonight.
Oh, okay.
And it says, yeah, that all looks legitimate. You know, banks are already using some of this. I mean,
yeah,
you lob into a country that has a reputation for fraud without having told your bank first, take out some money from the ATM, chances are your phone will ring before you've walked more than 20 metres.
It can be very annoying, actually. Well, lots of stories where we've had that cancelled. So, look, finally, in terms of talking about what's coming down the lines in terms of technology, Google have just had a big conference called I.O., where they've got their developers together and previewed some of the technology that they're going to be introducing into their products over the next little while, Android phones and various other things. Belinda, what are some of the things that Google is going to bring to the table soon?
Well, I don't know about you still, but I find these conferences kind of a little bit of a catch-up and a little bit of a draw ahead, then another catch-up, then a draw ahead.
There's a natural cycle to this, isn't there? The vendors at the big end of town will announce their new systems, and often it's a kind of three-year plan ahead, and you can see what's coming. And so, they'll announce it, they release it to the developers, all of the programmers. They then can start playing with this technology to see what might be possible in it. And then you see the kind of consumer applications, what, a year later perhaps, Belinda?
Yeah, 18 months.
So they may not all actually translate into products, but there's always some clever ideas. So what is the cutting edge of what Google's been doing, Belinda?
There are. Well, I guess the biggest one is the next version of Android, version 5, called Android L. This introduces a design component. So this gives all Android appearances a nice sort of consistent view, which is quite nice.
That'd be a nice change from the...
Yes. It's Android L, not Android Hell. Let's just be very clear. It's a letter L.
L. Yes, L for love.
Oh, dear.
And then, I'm sorry.
L for love. Anyway, look, sorry. So that they're making the design more consistent and nifty.
That's right. There's a couple of watches. So Samsung Gear Live and LG G Watch are both going to run Android Wear operating system. This uses voice control, which is, I think, fantastic because watches are very small and fiddly. And when I run with my Garmin, I often mash the wrong button.
So you're going to be...
voice control is great.
Like Dick Tracy talking into your phone, but you won't be
pretty
calling
much.
The chief. You'll be telling it to play Coldplay or whatever it might
That's
be.
That's right, or taking your heart rate or whatever it is.
Okay.
Yep. And also, Android Auto was announced. This is a bit of a catch-up to Apple CarPlay, which was launched at an auto show in Geneva in March. So this is where you plug in your Android device to your car and then off you go. You can use your touch dashboard or you can use voice control and you just say where you want to go and it will give you directions, etc.
Okay, so interesting things. And I guess one of the big questions is around with smartwatches. I mean, this is I've read for months that this is the next thing coming down the pipeline. But are they at a point really where they're really worth getting it, or are they just the sort of thing, kind of like Google Glass, where people who are really hardcore into technology might get them, but your ordinary consumers are just going to be, why would I want to wear one of those?
I'm of the latter, actually.
I can
understand some people might think they're cool, and I did see a guy on the train the other day wearing Google Glass, and I thought, nah.
Yeah.
There might be a market out there. Not for me personally. Sounds like not for you either still.
No, look, it's one of those things. I haven't worn a wristwatch since I left working for the ABC in 1991.
Oh, why did you ever leave still?
I finally did not have to time things down to the second, and it was very liberating just to take it off. Look, I do find it valuable not to be constantly plugged into the world's data, much as I am connected to the internet.
Oh, my goodness.
Probably more... than many people. Yeah, I know. It's a thing, but
even still, Gary has a limit on being wired. There you
absolutely.
Go. You heard it here first.
You go crazy otherwise. It's you know, it's not healthy for you, quite frankly. But I'm still waiting to see what the actual benefit is of talking to your wrist instead of reaching into pocket for your phone or having a Bluetooth headset or something. I'm not that desperate for those few seconds. I don't answer the phone anyway, I suppose. There's that medical data kind of tracking thing, but that still to me seems like an excuse, you know, a gadget in search of an excuse.
Yeah.
Now, I may be wrong because let's look at Apple.
It's very,
Apple
very
have
early days.
A rumored thing coming out soon. Now, everyone talks about the iWatch, and I don't know. A couple of us were suggesting the other day that maybe that's just a gigantic troll by Apple to get all their competitors wasting money on these smartwatches, and in fact, they're going to release something else like their cars.
What do you reckon, Belinda? Have you seen any of these products? There's certainly a few generations. I think Samsung have released a couple of different goes at a smartwatch so far. You sound unconvinced thus far.
That's exactly right, yeah. I am unconvinced. The Samsung watches have been out. If you look on eBay, they're everywhere.
That's what it takes for itself, isn't it? So quickly released and then quickly unsold after the person's tried them.
Pretty much, not into them.
Yeah, look, I'm interested to see. I'm exactly the sort of person who will buy a watch because they think it'll make them healthier rather than going and actually doing some exercise. So I may well be the market for that. I guess we'll find out if
that,
they...
That again is probably the way most people end up using them.
It's the opposite of a killer app. It's a life-saving app, I don't know.
People buy diet books rather than just not eating.
Oh, yeah, but every time I move house, the number of diet books I've had, I burn a lot of calories moving them from one house to another. That's about it. Look, thank you very much for that. Really great to hear from you both. Belinda, we will catch you at the conversation.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
Belinda Smith is the Deputy Science and Technology Editor at theconversation.com. And Stilgarian, we'll find you tweeting at Stilgarian and on CrikeyNZDNet, among others.
All over the place. Thanks, Dom.